All right. Now it is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. Please offer a warm Valley Group welcome to Carol.
Hey, Mandy. Hi, everybody. My name is Carol, and I am an alcoholic. And can everybody hear me okay? Okay, because I can't hear myself up here. I've been told to share three things when I share from the podium. One is I have a sobriety date. It's August 30th, 1983. And I have a sponsor. Her name is Karen H. in Bakersfield. And I have a home group. It's a Saturday Select Speakers Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that meets every single Saturday night at 7:30. Northminster Presbyterian Church, 3700 Union Avenue. If you're ever in town on Saturday night, come and visit us because we have a great meeting. It's a place of fellowship and fun and fabulous speakers. And I want to thank Bill for asking me to come up and share tonight. You can talk to him after. You know, if I get in God's way, you won't hear much of a message. If I stay out of God's way, you might hear something that might help you. That's all I can do. What I tell everybody at every meeting I go to is that I have nothing to say. And the reason I say that is because, left to my own devices, I really don't have anything to say. I've not been able to make good decisions and choices in my life. And all of my decisions and choices and actions brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I do have anything to say, it's because I get out of the way and God's message can get through to somebody who's here to hear it. And I'm grateful for that. And I want to welcome all the new people that are here tonight. And I also want to welcome anybody who might be new or may even have been here for a little while, but still haven't really made a decision if this is where you're supposed to be. I can tell you you're supposed to be here, but if you haven't made a decision as to whether you're going to stay or go, I'm here to tell you that whatever decision you make, whether it is to stay or go, it's going to affect the entire rest of your life. You know, I was fortunate enough when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that I was attracted to some people who wanted sobriety for me and gave me their time to talk to me and gave me the time to make the decision for myself, because I somehow knew when I got here, because I didn't come here because I was an alcoholic. I came here because the court, my second DUI. And the court sentenced me to six meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, whether I thought I needed them or not, whether I thought you wanted me here or not. And so I started coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I didn't come here to stay sober. I came here to get my court card signed and be on my way because alcohol wasn't my problem. And I'll explain that a little bit later, but so what I've discovered is that they loved me enough to allow me the time to make that decision for myself, because I somehow knew when I was new that if I left too soon, I might not have the opportunity to come back if I was an alcoholic. And I really believe that today, that had I not stayed, my life would be way different than what it is today. Because my life was on a path that was going to lead me to not only jail, but prison time. And my mom didn't raise me to be stuck in prison. And so that's where my life was headed. And I didn't know that. So what happened for me is that I did not pick up a drink until after I left home. I left home in 1966. Actually, it was 1965, the day after Christmas that year. And by early January, I had my first drink, but I don't remember much about that drink. But early on, in when I finally started drinking, alcohol did something for me that nothing else had ever been able to do. It allowed me to get out of myself, stop thinking about myself that way, that I could get on the dance floor and dance. I could converse with you. I could carry conversations. I could be whatever I thought you wanted me to be. And I was lively because I could not be lively without alcohol. I was stuck against the wall. I didn't know how to talk to people. I didn't know what to say. In high school, if you said hello to me in the hallway, my reaction was to turn 180 degrees and go running in the opposite direction because I didn't know what to say back. And alcohol, I discovered early on, changed all of that for me. It made me feel pretty. It made me feel like I was alive. Nothing had ever made me feel like I was alive and I could participate in the party. I could participate in life. I could, at that particular time, my dad had died 6 months earlier. He died in May of 1965. And for the first time, I could unleash my emotions, my anger, my tears, all of the stuff tied to my dad's death. Alcohol gave me free rein to experience those as best I could and let go with it. And I loved that about alcohol. I loved it. I had my first blackout in July 5th, 1966. I remember because it was my roommate's birthday. I came home from work that day. We were living in D.C. I was born and raised in Ohio. I was living in D.C. And I came home from work the day of her birthday. She said, "We're celebrating." And she handed me a drink. And at the time, she was drinking I.W. Harper in a 12-ounce glass. And it was about three-quarters full of I.W. Harper with some ice and a little splash of Coke on top of it. And so she handed me this drink. I don't remember finishing that drink. There was a picture of me laying sitting on the floor. I always had my head down. And we went out dancing that night. We went to places. I wound up the next morning with a cigarette burn on my wrist and a big blister where the cigarette had burned, and with a hangover that I didn't know what it was. I didn't know it was a hangover. I thought I was just sick. And so I went to work. Everybody at work knew what was wrong with me. I didn't know. When they finally gave me some aspirin and I finally took it, I took the aspirin and I quickly got sick, ran to the ladies' room and threw up. And when I got home that night, my roommate said, "Here's your problem. You're not used to drinking, so you haven't had enough to drink to build up your tolerance to alcohol. So if you just drink a little bit more, you'll build up your tolerance and that stuff won't happen to you anymore." Because it wasn't happening to her. So I believed her and I set about learning how to drink and learning how to build up my tolerance to alcohol. Eventually, I felt like I could drink most everybody under the table. But what I didn't understand was that when I took that first drink, it set all the others in motion. I did not understand. I did not know that until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And even when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, it took some time for that to settle in. And what happened for me is that when I took that first drink, I had no control over how many more I was going to have, when I was going to stop, or what I was going to do. And so it was like that from the very beginning for me. But I loved what it did. Like the big book says in the doctor's opinion, I love the effect produced by alcohol. And without it, I was nothing. With it, I could be anything. And it filled all, as Clancy would say, it filled all those empty holes that I had inside. And I loved it. I started experiencing some trouble with alcohol early on, but I never made a connection. Is there some water or something? I never made the connection. I will tell you that when I was new to California, I met this guy. We were introduced to pot for the first time. I'd never seen it, heard about it, but never knew what it was. And, you know, that stuff never interested me. I was more interested in drinking because it gave me life. Any kind of drug just put me in a corner, kind of vegging out, and that was really not a lot of fun for me. And so early on, I went back home. I moved back to Ohio in December, the first year we were here. And we got here in August and moved back to Ohio in December, came back in February. And around May, I wasn't feeling really good, and I thought something was really wrong with me. So I found a doctor and went to the doctor, and he pronounced me pregnant. And I said, how can I be pregnant? I haven't done anything with anybody. And apparently I had.
No.
I know. Impossible as it is, I knew it couldn't have been immaculate conception. But 2 months later, on July 20th, 1960, thank you. On July 20th, 1967, and July 20th is an important date for me. July 20th, 1967, I gave birth to a boy. I gave him up for adoption, and the best thing I did ever until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous was made the decision to allow him to, I hope, have a life with a family and normalcy, because what I was about to embark on was a life of alcoholism, and that child would have been blamed for everything wrong in my life. Everything. And I could have made that child's life miserable. And I'm so grateful today that I didn't do that. I'm grateful that I love the child enough to give him up. And that's what I feel that I did. So, I was having problems with alcohol early on. It was another year later that I had my first arrest. And while alcohol was involved in the incident, we were just dumb. And by this time, my roommate and I had deteriorated from a pretty decent apartment. We decided not to work for a while. So we were living in a cockroach-infested one single room. And while we were living there, we met some rather shady characters. And one night, one brought some stolen jewelry to our little place. And long story short, we were later arrested. A few days later, we were arrested for accessory after the fact and an armed robbery. They also found some pot in the room. And so we went through court. And you know, God has always been active in my life, whether I have known it, acknowledged it, or not. And one of the things that happened was that typically when two people are arrested and the circumstances as they were, at least back then, they were usually separated and not allowed to associate with each other. The courts did not do that to us. And so I would not have been able to survive without somebody that I could lean on for some help. Alcohol continued to take care of me. And later when we went back to work, moved down to Redondo Beach and lived there for a while. But alcohol was everything to me. And my thinking was clouded by self and denial of having any issues, denial of being an alcoholic, denial of alcohol playing that kind of role in my life. And so I give you this example as how my thinking worked and what kind of stuff I did behind alcohol. This roommate, when we were no longer living together, and she was with a guy living in the Hollywood Hills, invited me over one night because she had a new drink she wanted me to try. The drink was a mix of cold duck beer and vodka. And after you've had a couple drinks, it's fine. The first couple of drinks don't go down so easy, but after the couple, it's fine. So anyway, I have to work the next day, and later that night, I want to go home. Well, they're not going to let me drive home, so they get my car keys and won't let me go. Now, they're living in Hollywood Hills on the second story of a two-story house in the hills. So I'm mad. I go out on the balcony, and I'm trying to devise a way, how can I get my car keys back so I can get home, because I have to go to work. And if you're an alcoholic of my type, you have to go to work, because if you don't go to work, it might mean you're an alcoholic. And the last thing I wanted to do was admit that I might be an alcoholic, because all I knew about alcoholics is that if you're an alcoholic, you can't drink. I didn't want to not drink. And so I'm standing out there on the balcony, and I'm on the edge over here, and I look over. My car is right here. It's right there against the rail, and I'm thinking, I can just get over there. I have never in my life been athletic. I was always the last one as a child to be picked on the baseball team. Never, I don't run, I don't do anything. I am not athletic at all. But I'm thinking, it's just right there. If I just crawl over the balcony and reach, I'll grab hold of the rail, I'll pull myself up, I'll get in my car, travel home. Nobody's even going to know I'm gone. So I set out to accomplish my goal. I climb over the balcony and I reach for the rail. It's at that point that I realize that I've miscalculated the distance. And so I can't reach it, but I also can't pull myself back up over the balcony. So now I'm stuck and my arm is getting weaker. And so down I go. Now, I used to say I landed in a cactus bush. Now, this girl and I have, at that point, I was banished from that home, I'll just have you know, and they gave me my car keys. They couldn't get rid of me fast enough that night. But I since then, she and I have reconnected, and so last year, she says to me, she says, "Remember the night you jumped off the balcony?" I said, "I did not jump off the balcony. I had a plan." She said, "All I know is that someone at the party," I said, "There was a party?" I said, "I thought it was just you and Larry." She said, "No, it was a large party." I said, "Oh my God, I did not know that. All these years, I did not know that." And I said, "But I didn't jump." So I told her what my plan had been. And she and her mom were having a gut-splitting laugh. But I said, I always told people I fell into a cactus bush, but I honestly don't know if that's what it was. She said, "Wait a minute. My brother was there. I'll call him. He'll know." I said, "No, you don't have to do that." And what I've had it confirmed is that it was a cactus bush that I landed in. I did not go see a doctor because how do you explain that backache and the pain that you've got in your back to a doctor when... So I did. But that's where my alcohol took me. It also took me during my mom's illness. She was diagnosed with cancer in 1977. And it was when she was diagnosed with cancer that I mentally, emotionally, and spiritually disconnected with any God in the universe. I wanted nothing to do with this God that I had grown up with, this God of church, this God of hate, this God of vengeance. I wanted nothing to do with that. And that was the moment that I turned away emotionally, spiritually, and mentally. And so I got my first 502 while she was sick. There were no serious repercussions from that. I tried to blame my drinking on her. The judge wasn't having any of it. I don't even remember what the sentencing was. And she later passed away. And you know, God, I was working for an alcoholic boss at the time. And every afternoon at 3 o'clock or earlier, the bottle would come out and we'd start drinking. And the company was going bankrupt. There were days that we'd go out to lunch, the group that was left, we'd go out to lunch and would not bother to go back into work. A keeper put into the office, and I'd been drinking, so I was so proud of myself because I wasn't afraid to tell him to get out of there and talk him into leaving, because I could do that when I was drinking, but I'm grateful because what happened was that alcoholic boss that I was working for gave me a gift that nobody else could ever have given me, and this is God working in my life back then. He gave me my mom's last 30 days. He paid for me to go back to Ohio three times that year. And the last time I went was over the Christmas holidays. And as I was about ready to come back, we didn't think she'd last another week or two. So I called and he said, "Stay. Stay until you're ready to come back." I did not lose a dime of my salary while I was there. He paid me for everything. And he gave me her last 30 days, so I was able to spend it there. And one of the amazing things that I look back on was that I was able to allow her to be who she was and not treat her like she was dying and not going to be there again. And that was so important to her and to me. And I didn't overreact. We were all as a family together that year. And that was a God gift for me. My second 502 came on my way home from drinking, and I was pulled off the freeway in Southern California, and I knew I was in trouble when I couldn't recite the ABCs first or second time. And that was the time I went back to Sybil Brand Institute for Women. And no, I was taken to Van Nuys Court that day, Van Nuys Jail that time. And but that was the 502 that ultimately sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was in the courthouse. I went through a trial rather than cop a plea, just a lesser reckless driving, because I knew a reckless driving is held against you as a prior when I got my next 502, because I knew I was going to get my next 502. There was no question about it in my mind. And so when I'm standing there, I'm standing in the lobby of the Van Nuys courthouse looking out over Van Nuys. And the bailiff comes out when the jury's deliberating, and he says, you know, the jury could go either way, find you guilty or not guilty. So if you go home tonight and you just ask God to, you know, pray that they come back with a not guilty, they just might. And I stood there, and I didn't say this to him, but in my mind I said, I would never ask God to do, I turned away from, I don't want anything to do with him. I will not do that. But as I stood there and I looked out, I looked out over the city of Van Nuys, and here's what I saw. I saw my life of my next 502. At the time, the sentencing was getting more severe. And I saw my next 502, and I saw the one after that, and I saw the one after that, until all I can see for my life is prison. And in looking at that vision, I knew without a single doubt in my mind, there was not a thing I could do to change it. Not a thing I could do to change it. Never once did it ever occur to me that if you don't pick up a drink, you won't get a 502. Today, I think about that, and I'm incredulous that that thought never even occurred to me. Because I knew, and probably the reason it couldn't occur to me was because I knew I couldn't operate without drinking. And so the jury brought back that guilty plea, and I was sent to 6 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I said, I didn't want to be here, I didn't want to come here, and I didn't want to hear what you had to say, because I wasn't an alcoholic, didn't want to be an alcoholic, didn't want to stop drinking. And so about 2 days before I came to my first meeting, I was working for a woman in West L.A. And about 2 days before, you know, it occurred to me that perhaps I could do this one of two ways. I could come and stand in the corner, arms crossed, body stiff, and dare you to approach me or say anything to me, dare you to get through to allow me to hear anything. Or maybe I could go to these meetings and find out why my brothers drink the way they do and what I could do to make them stop. It gave me exactly what I needed, which was an ear to hear. You know, the big book tells me that all we need to open the door of anything is the key of willingness. And it doesn't take much willingness. It takes just a little sliver of willingness to allow us to open that door. And once that door is open, as long as we have willingness to continue forward, the results are amazing. And so that little bit of willingness I had to listen, whether it's for the right reason or the wrong reason, in this world it doesn't matter. What matters is that we listen and we hear. And what I heard when I went to that very first meeting that night was a woman from the podium just like this at Valley Presbyterian Hospital in Van Nuys. And all of our outsides were different. None of our outsides were really similar, but our insides were totally intact and alive, the same. She was lonely in a room full of people. She was worthless. She had nothing to give. I came in here, there was nothing on my insides at all. I would scream in my head at the phone when it would ring, stop, I can't, you have got nothing you can take anymore. There's nothing left. It's gone. Everything in me is gone. And she talked about those things. She talked about my insides. And I left that meeting not convinced I was an alcoholic, but I was finally convinced that I wasn't alone anymore. There's one other person in this entire planet who knew how I felt and had experienced the same feelings and the same thoughts. And I didn't make any connection to alcohol. I couldn't make any connection how alcohol and not drinking could change any of that. I went back finally after a number of weeks. This was early June. I finally went back in August because I had to hurry up now and get my court card signed. And the second speaker I heard was Father Sean down at Valley Presbyterian Hospital. And Father Sean talked about his high tolerance for alcohol. And I sat up a little straighter in my chair because by now I'm sitting down. And he also followed the how proud he was of that high tolerance with what happened to him later. And that tolerance began to slip away. And it took less alcohol for him to get drunk. It took less alcohol for him to go into a blackout. And I somehow knew intuitively that that was applying to me and that what he was saying applied to me. And so I went back to my third meeting. And by my third meeting, there were these two guys, Dewey and Hank, that were situated across from me and that coaxed me into that seat. And they would sit there across from me. And they were laughing and joking. And I'm thinking, these two guys are on a court card just like me. And they're making fun of me because they can see I must have a sign across my head that I'm taking this a little bit seriously, that I'm beginning to be like the speakers and what they're talking about. And I didn't want to talk to them, but they wouldn't let me go. And Dewey and Hank would talk to me after the meeting, and it was Dewey after my fifth meeting or so, stood and talked to me after the meeting, and he asked me the question. And the question was, do you want to stop drinking? My head was saying no. I don't want to stop drinking. It's not what my problem is. And what came out of my mouth, I call it my little jack-in-the-box. It's so buried deep down inside, that little piece of me that was still alive and wanted to live. I call it my little jack-in-the-box because that lid popped open, and what popped out of my mouth was yes. And when it popped out of my mouth, I was just as stunned as if somebody had slapped me alongside the face and knocked me silly, because I did not know it was there. And it surprised me. So he said to me, why don't you try 30 days without a drink? And I was attracted to Dewey. I'd do anything for a date. I was interested in a date. And so I said, okay. And as I'm walking away, I'm saying, don't you understand? I can't not drink. I have to drink to do what I do. I have to drink to live the way I live. And yet I had made that commitment for 30 days. It was at my last meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on the court card that someone gave me a big book, wanted me to buy it. I said, no, I don't have the money. He says, okay, take it. No, let me pay for it. No, you can't pay for it now. And so forced the big book on me, and because I didn't have to pay for it, I took it home and I started to try to read it. To me, it was the worst piece of literature I'd ever read, and it was tedious going, but I did it. And there's one line in there that when I finally got to that page and saw it, and by the time I was part of Alcoholics Anonymous and I read that line, I can't quote the big book. We find that when we look at our past, we made decisions based on self, which placed us in positions to be hurt. That line jumped out at me because I knew what it was talking about. I knew that the decisions and actions I had taken had placed me in positions to be hurt. And I didn't know how to stop doing that. I didn't know how to change doing that. And Dewey told me I needed a sponsor. I finally had a woman volunteer. And so when he asked me the next time, I say, yes, I have a sponsor. She was the best person for me. And God has always provided. And she's the one who asked me 10 days after I had my last drink, which was August 19th, 1983. She's the one who asked me 10 days later, are you doing anything besides drink? Now, I wasn't going to tell anybody. I had heard a long time ago that if you're having trouble getting to work because you're up too late and too hungover, have a diet pill before you go to bed and another diet pill when you get up. That way you can sleep a little bit, still get up on time and make it to work. And so I wasn't going to tell anybody I was doing that. And again, Jack popped out and told her the truth. She said, why don't you go home tonight and not take that diet pill, and when you get up tomorrow morning, which was August 30th, 1983, don't take that diet pill. And she's the one who taught me that as I began participating in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I love that you asked for the hands of alcoholics. I saw some hands not raised, and I don't know if you're alcoholic or not alcoholic. But when she told me that my participation would help my acceptance of being an alcoholic, I started obeying. I started surrendering. I started beginning to accept, and it came in little pieces for me. At first, it was my hands under the table and a finger would raise just to satisfy her that I was participating in some way. That little action eventually brought my hand and arm on top of the table, and I can now raise it high in the air because I am an alcoholic, and I'm so grateful that I know that today. And she's the one who suggested, why don't you go home tonight and ask God to relieve you of the obsession and compulsion and desire that you have for alcohol. You know, I don't believe in God. I don't believe God's going to do anything for me. And it might work for you guys, but it's not going to work for me. And just to show you, I'll prove it to you. So I went home that night. And for me, getting on my knees meant on my knees in bed. You know, I wasn't going to get on the floor or anything like that. I wasn't going to lower myself in any way like that. But there was a little, I had a bedroom window, and there was a star that shone through the leaves of a tree that was out there. And that became God for me. And I said this prayer, and I don't remember my exact words, but I asked God to please remove from me any obsession, compulsion, and desire that I have to drink today. And what happened for me was that I have since discovered that that was that piece of me that wanted to live beyond anything else. That Jack popped out, and it was a prayer of sincerity. And I knew that I meant it, and tears fell from my eyes because I was so surprised and shocked. And that was my beginning. And what I discovered is that every night, that star, whether it was rainy, shiny, cloudy, whatever, for a brief moment, I could see that star through that window every night that I can remember. And that was God. That was the beginning of God for me. The God that I have in my life today is, I call God fluid, because God has grown over the years into a God of such love, compassion, and understanding for each and every one of us that is beyond any inkling of human understanding and comprehension that I have available to me. It is beyond the words that I can express. I have a dependence on God today that belies everything I do. My goal every day is to live God as God would have me live. I have been given gifts in this program that are beyond anything I thought possible. I was not someone that could be married. July 20th, I told you, is a date that is special to me. And every year on that child's birthday, I chastise myself for being so worthless. God can't give you anything without you breaking it, without you losing it, without you not taking care of it. And I'm not one who could ever be married because I am too self-centered. I'm too interested in the conquest and the moving on, because if you like me, there must be something wrong with you. But as I began to change in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was guided into different actions, you know, I was guided to begin to notice where my actions led to my feelings that I wanted to drink. Where my actions led to my feelings of wanting to run and hide, and start looking at how those actions were triggering things that I did. And so I had people surrounding me that helped me spot those actions so I could begin to change the actions. And when I changed the actions, those feelings went away. And as I began relying on God to teach me and help me to react differently to situations and to people and to things, those things started to happen. And so I was not one who could be married. And so I was 2.5 years sober, and I had a friend from Bakersfield who was running a recovery home for women down south, and she wanted me to come to the fundraiser on Sunday, July 20th that year, 1986. And I said, no, I don't really want to. Sunday's my day at home. I'm going to stay at home. And so I was at the Friday night Valley Presbyterian meeting. Somebody was selling tickets for this fundraiser. Ticket numbers were 118 and 119. I'll do the math for you. That child was 18 that year, and it was going to be 19 on the 20th. So I said, okay, I'll buy the tickets, but I'm still not going because I don't have anybody to go with. I'm not going. And then I found somebody to go with. So we go to this fundraiser, and Carol says, come on in. I got some friends from Bakersfield, and I want you to meet them. So I go in. It's crowded. I can't wait to get out. And I met this guy named Ken Bilto. And it took until he got my number that night, and it took until early August before we finally went out. It took him another 60 days before he asked me to marry him. I had dinner with a friend at the end of August, and I said, if I'm ever going to get married, this is the person. And we were married on March 21st, 1987. And with that July 20th, 1986, I knew that God had forgiven me and that I needed to forgive myself. Because God replaced something that gave me pain with something that gave me joy and happiness. And so Ken and I were married. And briefly, because I'm almost out of time, some of the things that have happened over the course of my sobriety that has brought me to this God that is in my life today. In 1993, I needed to go back to Ohio. I needed to go. I knew somebody was going to be leaving this earth, and I think I always know who, because there's still a piece of me that thinks I'm God. And so I couldn't go until October, but I got back there. Nobody died before I went. I got back there, and I spent some time with my sister. Actually, we got to spend a week together. And the odd things that happened while I was there was she was working the day I got there, so I went shopping because I wanted to make dinner for her. And when she got home, I not only had dinner made, but I wanted to serve her. I didn't want her to serve herself. She'd worked hard all day, and she deserved the time. And so it was a week like that. And it was a week because I wanted her to get down to Kentucky to see my stepfather because I knew that's who was going to die. And so we got down to Kentucky, and we went down to visit friends and my stepfather, and we had sister talks. We spent an entire week together. We went for ice cream and strolls in Oxford, Ohio, and I accepted her and her family exactly as they are. The first time that had ever happened for me. And I loved it. And so while we were leaving my stepfather's, and we were talking, and she told me the one thing I had done that had hurt her to her core. So when I talk about the things that we do as alcoholics and our self-centeredness, because we're only thinking of ourselves, we have little respect or care for anybody else in our lives, whether we care about them or not. When she told me what it was, and I can tell you that when we steal, we don't steal the tangible things. Those are replaceable. Those you can pay back. We steal the memories. We steal the things of the heart. And those can't be replaced. And I don't know how what we need to do. But I got to make amends to her for what I did. And it was, I still say, inadequate. But it was what it was. And so I left her home the following day to go down to spend my last day with my stepfather, who I knew was going to die before I got back there again. And as I'm driving out of her driveway, I'm sobbing. I haven't sobbed in a long time when I left home, but I'm sobbing. I almost pull off on the side of the road. And I will tell you that God was present in the car when we did this amends thing. And I didn't understand it, so I went down to my stepfather's, and I left there the following day, not a tear, and no regrets, nothing. And so I come back to Bakersfield, and I told Ken, I said, I had the best ever time with my sister. I can't wait to go home and do it again. And 3 weeks later, the call came, and she had dropped dead. I basically have a heart attack. And in that moment, I felt God's presence surrounding us. I felt a peace and serenity, even in calamity. I felt a sense of peace and serenity that everything was just exactly the way it was supposed to be. I had no regrets. At some point, I realized that I had been given a God gift, and that God gift is that gift of goodbye that I could have missed. And I could have missed as being able to see what it really was. And so that's one of the things that's happened in sobriety. And sobriety has given me, and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has given me new eyes to see things from a different perspective. And it's a perspective, it's a God perspective that I know everything is all right. And so a number of years later, I will quickly tell this, and it's hard to tell this with, you know, because I learned a lot about my program and me by some of the things that have happened. And my husband and I were back in Michigan where he was from with his family, and his sister comes running into the bedroom and says, "What the hell's wrong with my brother?" And I said, "Nothing. I don't." She said, "Well, he can't remember anything." And I said, "Well, I don't know. I just thought it was a husband-wife thing. He says something I don't remember. I say something he doesn't remember until it's important." And we came back and we went to Sansom, and they put him on Aricept, which is the Alzheimer's medication. And that started a journey of my own denial that he could possibly have that. I had him go from doctor to doctor, test to test, trying to make it anything but what it was. And that went on for probably 3 years. And in the middle of his disease, I had a sponsor who finally convinced me, because, you see, I always think it's about me. Always think it's about me. And when he would forget to take his medication that I'd lay out for him every day when I went to work, he'd forget. I came home one time and he hadn't taken his noon pills, and I started being mad at him, and he just looked at me and he says, "I forgot." And I said, "Oh, I'm about this tall." And so Rachel was finally able to help me see that it's his disease was not about me. And when that was finally revealed to me and I could finally accept, we had some really wonderful moments. I say today that we made that journey together. It's just that his journey was different than my journey, but we made it together. You know, and toward the end, he started wandering away, and there were a couple of people in the program that I could call, and there's one guy who was just so tuned right to where he is, and would find him almost immediately and bring him home. And sometimes he started being gone for 6 and 7 hours at a time. And so he finally had to be placed in a facility for his safety. And so I would go to the facility. It was the hardest thing I ever had to do, and I still have regrets over it, but I had no choice. And so I would bring him home, and some days would be wonderful, some days would be very hard. And But when I was visiting him at the facility, I was there one day and I suddenly realized that when I was there, I was with him. I wasn't shopping in my head. I wasn't cleaning house. I wasn't worrying about the dogs. I was with him. I was present in that moment. And that was a real blessing. That was a real blessing. And I hadn't even realized that it was that way. And toward the end, some months before, I started thinking, I hope someone loves me enough to let me go. Love me enough to let me go. And so I started praying to God that I would be able to love him enough to let him go when the time came. And that I would know when the time was there to be able to do that. And so the time came. And I told the staff, it's okay if he doesn't want to eat. He's on his way. And I was there. And toward the last week, I'd ask God to please, because you see, again, I think it's all about me. I can't understand anything he's trying to say to me. I think it's because I can't hear well. I think it's, you know, it's me. And so I say this prayer to God, and I say, please, help me to hear what I need to hear and understand what I need to understand. And on Halloween, October 31st, that year, I'm laying next to him and I'm rubbing his arm, holding his hand. And I say out loud, because I can't look at him and talk because I don't want him to see me cry. And I say out loud, I said, honey, I wish I knew what I could do to help you. And out of his mouth were the last two words that I ever heard him say that I could understand as clearly as I hear you. And those two words were, you are. And I know today that was God talking to me through him to tell me that everything is okay. I am so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. Too many times I'd have missed this whole thing for a drink. A drink. I was placed myself into situations where I could be hurt. I was raped in Las Vegas in late 1970s, and I blacked it out until I was sober. And we talked about going over to the Riviera for a roundup over there. And every time they talked about going, it was fun. But when they mentioned the Riviera, my stomach would turn, my skin would just crawl, and I didn't know why. And I just kept looking, looking, looking until I could remember what happened to me there at the Riviera in one of those rooms. I placed myself into that situation for a drink. Nobody forced me there. Nobody took me there. I did it. And when Ken and I went over there some years later, I was still worried about it. In 20 years, some sober. We go over for the roundup, and I'm still worried about walking into that room and what I'm going to feel like and what's going to be. And we walk into that room, and it's just like it was that night. Same setup, same. And I was okay. And I knew once again, God had forgiven me, and I can forgive myself. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love everything it's done for me, everything it's given me. I am a complete person today. I hold my head high. I have respect. I have respect for myself. I care about myself and I care about my fellow human beings. And that is a far cry from the person who walked in here who was so self-centered and so self-seeking that I would use you until I couldn't get from you what I thought I needed or wanted. And I would be done with you. And I hope you find here what I have found, and I've gone way over. Thank you guys for being here.
Thank you.